So I'm recording this, and there's three purposes of our visit today. The first one is to give you a context for understanding romantic nature, romanticism in nature, particularly with reference to your essay question. And we're going to do that by looking at early Australian painting. Now, why do that? Well, it's something really interesting. One of the Australian artists actually lived where Wordsworth lived, in the Lake District, and did his early painting as a romantic artist in England. And then he migrated to Australia, and we're going to see some very interesting carryovers of his romantic views to the Australian landscape. And to romantic artists, the Australian landscape was in many ways amazing, because, you know, the romantics were looking for something that was free, like Eden, not contaminated by industry. So Australia, if you could forget the whole business about imprisonment and convicts, Australia was like a revelation. So Australia and romanticism really fit together quite interestingly. So that's the first thing we're going to do. We're going to look at romantic landscapes in the Australian context. Then the second thing we're doing is we're moving into the room of European 18th and 19th century art. And I want to kind of bring back into focus for you just how different the Romantics were from the Enlightenment. And then the last thing we're going to do is we're going to move into Victorianism, which is the main bulk part of the last part of this unit. And that's it. Any questions? Not so far. Good. If you have any questions, ask them. Let's go. John Glover, and Ulswater, 1824. Now, Ulswater is in the Lake District in England, and when you look at that painting up there, it immediately prompts all sorts of questions about what did the Romantics gain from the landscape? How did they see the landscape? Come back a little bit. And, you know, some of the thoughts that come to me as I look at this, and you might have your own thoughts, is that Wordsworth talks about, in the preface to Lyrical Ballads, he talks about the beauteous forms of nature. And I think that he's saying something about the way that the shapes of nature, like the mountain shapes, are almost alive in the way that they kind of can influence and impress certain qualities, certain powers on our thinking, on our imagination. Those mountains have got this incredible, you know, they're almost alive in there. You can see the muscular force underneath the covering of trees. And the lake, which is reflecting those mountains, is incredibly still. There's this kind of contemplative stillness about the landscape. And then you've got this valley in the front here, which is natural and rugged. It's got cows in there, so it's got a kind of a semi-pastoral quality to it. And that's, for me, most important. The whole colours of that landscape reflect somebody who's got a real joy, a real appreciation of the colours and the textures of that whole world that he's describing. You got any other thoughts about it at all?
I can't see what you say about the colour. It depends on which it's a big deal in terms of.
Yep.
Contrast with the sky and the shadow for the bottom quality.
Yep, good. Yeah. Vivid, good quality, yeah.
So, detail in the reflection tape.
Yeah. So, you know, whenever you have a painting like that, you sort of have, you know, it's how to kind of get into the feeling of the artist. You have to kind of ask yourself all those questions to get there. I mean, yes, you can look at it and something comes, impressions come, you either like it or dislike it. But when you're working on it, as we are, trying to see the links between this and poems written at the same time, you have to begin to kind of suggest formulating some way in which this landscape, how does it impress itself on the artist? What are the impressions he receives from it? And the impressions are all beneficent. Sort of the painting kind of breeds a sense of goodness, a sense of balance, a sense of life. You know, nature is not just an inanimate block of stone or wood. This is something kind of vibrant and alive in that painting, to my eyes. And as you say, Abdul, it comes through also the reflections, but also the contrast between the sunlight and the shade, the sunlight in the top left-hand corner, and the rhythm of the mountain as it comes down here, and the shade down here, the rhythm here. You know, paintings have a lot of movement and rhythm in them. If you start, your eye kind of follows the shapes around. You know, Wordsworth does this by repetition, dancing with the daffodils. You know, his poems, the language carries a certain rhythm of appreciation. This is my daughter. Just one second. Yes, Helen, I'm in the middle of taking a tour around the art gallery, but I can answer a quick question. The Baroque period, yep. Yep. Well, Bach is Baroque. Handel, not so much. Well, Baroque means very ornate, filled with all sorts of trills and all sorts of, you know, in addition to the melody, all sorts of frills. And Handel is less so than Bach, but. Yeah, I'm here. Is it still considered Baroque? I can't honestly answer that question. Yeah. Well, you've got to ask, well, what are the features of Baroque? Yeah, I'm here. You can't hear me. I'll talk to you later. She's doing an essay. She wants an answer. Okay. So, when John Glover came to Australia, came to Tasmania, in fact, in the 1830s, 10 years after he did this painting in the Lake District, came to Tasmania, what took his interest, what took his attention? How did he see the landscape? What did he notice? Similar things in terms of the beneficence of nature, maybe.
And also just the mountains in the background, and the trees just being a constant throughout the image.
Yep, the trees are more in the foreground here than there. Brigitte, any thoughts?
People.
Good, excellent. What does he see about the people? Who are these people? Very good, they're part of the nature. And what people are these? They're Aboriginals. So, you know, we know about what the Romantics thought about Aboriginals and primitive peoples, don't we? The Noble Savage and William Blake's depiction of the Aboriginal family. So this is a picture of the harmonious relationship between people and nature. And also these trees, I mean, they're not quite like how we see gum trees nowadays, but depicting these trees almost like dancers. There's something kind of very vital in the motion and the movement of those trees. There's something a bit tragic about this painting. When it was painted in 1838, most of these Aboriginals had been wiped out. Mid-1830s, there were hardly any Aboriginals left in Tasmania. So this is almost like a historical look back. Okay, so Lake District, early Tasmania with its Aboriginals, and then he produced these two paintings. Also Tasmania. This is a painting of his house and his property, his estate. This is a painting of part of his wilderness garden. So what can we say about these paintings? How is nature being depicted, and how is a man or woman's relationship to nature being depicted in these paintings?
Well, I'd say the depiction of his house, the nature's more sparse surrounding the area where the humans are, so they're not really, I guess, maybe the European style of housing and the European design is connected with nature.
Good, that's a good observation. So, you know, these people live in harmony with nature, but he's moved from this viewing the land as it was before European settlement, and he's now viewing his own land as it is with him being settled there. And what are his thoughts about that? I mean, is he criticizing himself? I mean, you might criticize him, but is he criticizing himself, I wonder? How is the landscape being depicted there? What's the relationship between this person and the landscape? How is that being described?
The person actually looks quite harmonious.
Yeah, the person looks quite harmonious, but he's an individual, isn't he? Sort of on his own. And he's almost got the Wordsworthian and pose of sitting there, you know, absorbing this.
Is that a self-portrait or is that him?
Well, it might be. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say that. But it's definitely his farm, Patterdale Farm. Depicts the artist's Australian property at Mills Plain in northern Tasmania, named after the town at the foot of the Ullswater Lake. So he's named his property after his place in England.
I was going to say, it looks like a combination of those two.
It's interesting, isn't it? Sort of imposed England on him in a way, hasn't he? It says, Patterdale Farm reveals the painter's distinctive technique whereby colour is applied in transparent veils with diluted layers of oil delicately brushed in over a cream-white ground. Glover's sensibility and refined evocation of the light and landscape of Tasmania made him one of the most admired painters in colonial Australia. What about this one up here? What could you say about the relationship between people and landscape in that painting? Landscape looks more untouched there. It's a white dog. It's their little doggy. That's what I think it is. No. And it's the artist and his wife, and he's holding a palette of paints in his hand. And he's painting the landscape, and his wife's sitting there watching him paint the landscape. So it's sort of a self-reflective painting about the artist in the landscape. That was something the Romantics often liked to do, to paint the artist in the landscape, appreciating the landscape for what it's worth, absorbing, like Wordsworth in that poem. Do you think we always have to be seeking, or can we be open to the powers that the landscape communicates to us?
I almost feel like it looks like it's seeking something, though.
Like what?
It's seeking something, because there's so much depth in the painting. It goes on, it looks like he wants to go explore.
That's an interesting thought. Yeah, that's good. That's a good thought. Opens up a sense of exploration of the continent. Yep, very good. Now, the Romantic landscape was not only this. this is sort of benign, harmonious world landscape. But if you compare the landscape of Wordsworth's Daffodils, I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud, to the landscape in Wuthering Heights. Have any of you studied Wuthering Heights yet at all? The landscape around the heath around Wuthering Heights, that's a very different landscape. It's a threatening landscape, but not only threatening. Well, what I'm trying to say is that in the Romantic period, there were these sorts of benign landscapes, but there was also, at the same time, there was a sense of landscape as being, let's see what it is, being what? Here's two good examples. Okay, go.
Overpowering almost.
Yeah, overpowering, dark. Can you see any figures in them at all? There's figures. What's the posture? What's that posture signify?
In awe.
Well done. So, you know, nature can be overpowering, but it can also be awe-inspiring. What does the word awe mean? What's it connected with? What's the connotations of awe?
Amazement.
Yep.
Almost greater.
Almost greater. Yeah. What's the almost greater if you say you're in awe of something?
You can't really believe it. Awe.
Wordsworth says in that poem that we're looking at, are there powers that can inform us, or do we always need to be seeking? So what's he talking about indirectly? God, he's talking about the divine. Awe is something that we have in front of something that's greater than humanity. Now, Abdul couldn't see any people in that picture there. I wonder if Brigitte can see some people in that picture. Yes! But what does it tell us that he's like that?
Tiny.
He's tiny, insignificant in the context of this overwhelming. This is the forest around Wollongong. Any of you been down there? Fitzroy Falls down there at all? That's what it's like down there. It's still like that in places. But so you see the early Australian artists, they either painted the landscape like that, benign, or it was like this, overwhelming, full of awe. There's a couple of other good examples of that over here, look. This is the Blue Mountains. Are there any people in this painting? Yes. Yes. Again, dwarfed into insignificance. This is the Upanapean River. But it's quite magical. Look at that sunlight in the middle there, coming down from up here somewhere. Quite amazing, really. So nature is kind of massive. I love that painting, it's just fantastic. Reminds me of some of the bushwalks I go on. You know, overwhelming kind of landscape. And this one here, look, this is by the same artist as what we just looked at. Eugene von Gerard. I didn't mention the fact that he's from Switzerland. So Glover is from England, Gerard is from Switzerland. And this is a bit later than Romanticism. It was painted in the 1870s. It's still got a lot of romantic features. Now, this is painted in New Zealand. Any of you been to New Zealand? Yeah. Have you been to Milford Sound? No. Well, this is Milford Sound in New Zealand. I haven't been there either. I'm dying to go there. Because if it looks like that, it must be absolutely amazing. And you've got people again here, look. And you've got a ship there, look. So what's the experience of nature that this painting is trying to express? What do you think?
So much bigger.
Yeah. So much bigger than us than what we can understand. Great, perfect. That's it. That's good. So is there a word you could use for that? Another word?
Awe.
Oh, you got it. Yes! Fantastic. Awe. awesome, isn't it? But there's an interesting additional element in this painting. You know, if you're a historian of art, you'd pick this out. It was painted after Charles Darwin's voyage of the Beagle and all that incredible interest in science that was happening in the mid-19th century. And so you've got this awe-inspiring kind of picture of the divine in nature. You've also got incredible geological and botanical detail. Almost every plant and every rock in the front here is painted with accuracy. And this is an artist who's, you know, wants to get the scientific factuality of nature as well as its kind of awe-inspiring qualities. So this is Romanticism, and you know, there's a lot of good illustrations here of romantic landscape. I'm sure you can weave some of this information into your discussion about Wordsworth. And now we're going to go into the next second stage of what we want to do, and that's to take you back to the Enlightenment and also to see if you can find one romantic painting in this Enlightenment room. And what your task is to identify what paintings William Blake would have hated like a plague. Why do I say that? Why did romantic artists like Blake, what did they hate so much about the Enlightenment? That's number one question. Number two question is, can you find a painting that has some qualities of romanticism in it? Okay, the leading question is, what dates are romanticism? Can you remember the dates of the Romantic movement? No? Guess.
Don't make me guess. I don't remember.
Guess. Can you guess, Abdul?
1718.
That's lukewarm.
Yeah, I was going to say 1700.
Lukewarm. 1701 to 1899. Lukewarm. Let's pull it in a bit. Let's pull it into a gap of 50 years. Which 50 years is it going to be? When did Queen Victoria come to the throne? 1837. That's when Victorianism started, 1837. So 50 years.
So it's the late 70s.
1780 to about 1830. So that will give you a clue to which of the paintings in the next room might have some elements of romanticism in it. Now you can work together, you can buddy up and go around and have a look at which paintings the romantics hated and which painting they would have perhaps resonated with. Let's go. Two questions. you're not looking only at landscapes. You're not. The whole room has got in it examples of what William Blake hated, and it's got one example of a romantic landscape. So broaden your gaze and don't necessarily walk in the direction you're walking. It's only this room. Okay, ACU students, gather here. I have to say that because otherwise everybody would come when I say okay. So, go. What have you found?
Well, just in terms of the obvious landscapes that we've driven, there's a major difference in the detail given to the trees as opposed to
Okay, tell us about the difference. Tell us.
Just
do you want to go to it? Do you want to get closer to it?
Well, there's a little bit more detail in this one. I'm sorry, Glove or Glovers, was it?
Yeah.
You were talking about the branches and the way that gives life to the painting, but there's none of that at all. There's just sort of different shades of green and some loose figures that are meant to look like a trunk. And as you pointed out earlier, they don't really look like romantic. Romance is just admiring the environment as much as they do like wealthy scholars or something like that. So there's a difference between the people portrayed and even the significance of the people. The people are still big and there's just not as much detail in anything natural in that photo.
But what drew you to this painting rather than any other one in the room?
I was drawn to this one because of the look of the sky and the depth that I saw similarities to the romantic paintings.
Yep. Okay. Is there anything else in this that has some similarity to the romantic paintings? Or not necessarily to the romantic paintings that we saw, but to the concerns and preoccupations of the romantics from what we know about them so far? Like, for instance, you go first.
I was just going to say, it's still reaching out, it's still yearning out into the distance, but the landscape is just flat and empty almost, comparatively.
Yep.
And it's just not as awe-inspiring
significant. That's true. I was going to ask, what sort of people do the romantics normally show an interest in? From what we've seen in, say, Wordsworth's preface to the Lyrical Ballads, in the poem I read in the lecture about Wordsworth finding the leech gatherer up in the mountains, what sort of people did the romantics gravitate towards and why?
People that were innocent.
That's it, that's right.
Those people aren't quite.
Well, there's actually two groups of people in this painting. And are they the same or are they different?
Yeah. They look poor. Maybe I'm just going because of the way that they're structured on the painting, just thinking.
Well, it's a bit hard to say exactly what they are, but to my eye, it's like there's either another woman or a man, and they're doing something that we can't see what it is, and this looks like a horse with a big collar that's maybe pulling a wagon, and they look like peasants or farmers to me.
That lady looks quite upset.
They look like sort of the peasant classes. These, I agree with you, it's more like educated, but I'm not sure what he's doing there. I had maybe the impression that he was painting it or sketching, which would fit in with what we saw in the Glover painting. Something like that. Now the other thing that's interesting, if you look at the landscapes over there, you notice the dates on those landscapes?
Yeah, they were earlier.
They're earlier. They're quite early, like early 1700, I think even 1658 or something. These landscapes are framed with trees on each side. There's something very deliberate in the kind of staginess of the scene that's presented. You've got a town or buildings in the middle distance. Here you've got some people in a rather deliberate pose in the middle of this painting. This one is not the same kind of staginess. You've got, as you say, it's not like the Glover, there's not a great interest in the trees, but there's no looking for making trees into a kind of frame of some stage. This tree is sort of there in its own natural right, just leaning over rather awkwardly, really. In fact, you could, if you were those artists, you'd come along here and say, well, hang on a second, this is an unformed painting. It hasn't tidied the things up. So in a way, that's sort of like what the Romantics did. They like to do things without tidying them up. They wanted nature to have a certain freedom from the sorts of constraints of the Enlightenment. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Now, to come back to the first question, what sort of people did the Romantics gravitate towards? Well, you already said, that these people are not the elite. I can't remember what word you used. Something. Upper class. So that gives you a clue as to which paintings Blake, maybe Wordsworth and Coleridge, but certainly Blake, what they would have hated for art to be make art a subject for art. What would they have hated most in this room? The witch? Look at this. That's it. The king and the crown. And it's actually not even a king, is it? I'm not sure. I can't remember. But do you know who that painting is by? Joshua Reynolds. And you probably don't remember, but I actually did mention that Blake hated Reynolds like a plague. Reynolds was the director of the Great Art Institute in London. And Blake felt that Reynolds was destroying art by, encouraging people to paint things like this. Because this was politically completely out of the framework of the Romantics. The Romantics wanted freedom, liberation, experience of nature, all that. And these things were kind of nailing a coffin on what art should really be. That's how they thought about it. Are there any other paintings in the room that would qualify for that sort of...
You said they are built.
What about the women in this room? What about them?
They're very fancy and they look quite self-obsessed.
Oh, good. All that. Fancy and self. And what about this lady here?
Tiny
puppy. Oh, yeah.
Looks like the fire skeleton of the 1700s.
That's right. Yeah, that's it. So the Enlightenment didn't have that kind of quest for freedom, openness to nature, spontaneous feeling, didn't have any of that quality in it. So this is not much in here to illustrate the Enlightenment, there's enough. But there's one other painting we're going to look at. Did you want to say something more?
Oh, I just wanted to say it looks like the Enlightenment's more about the perfection of humanity rather than inspiring nature.
Yeah, but then also, perfection of humanity within a certain social framework.
Yeah, the trying to move in through their paintings.
Yeah. Good. Okay, well, just bear in mind these two ladies, the blue ladies, for a minute, because I want you to make a comparison with another painting down here. Okay, this painting is a rather nice segue from that room. This painting was done in 1790, so that's well into the Romantic period. So what is it about this painting that distinguishes it from the portraits of the women in the previous gallery?
She's unstructured.
Yep, that's good. She's unstructured.
She has movement, like the trees.
Yep, she has movement. She's unstructured.
She doesn't look like she's in a robot.
No, all that.
And there's nature.
There is. Yep. What sort of person do you think she is? What's her occupation?
Maybe she entertains gentlemen?
Possibly.
She's dancing.
She's dancing. She was a dancer. She's French, but she became a famous dancer in London in 1797. And she took London by storm between 1797 and 1803 was the height of her career. So she's a dancer. And what about her face? How does her face compare with the faces in the previous room?
She looks more natural.
Yeah, more natural. More natural, more alive. She's almost stepping out of the painting. Abdul, if you get too close, she'll actually jump out into your arms. It's almost got that feeling in it, hasn't it? She's almost kind of coming out at you. So that's a strong romantic portrait compared to the portraits of the Enlightenment portraits in there. And particularly the fact that there's this movement and dancing. And we didn't talk about the colours, but there's incredible variety of colour there, the golds, the silvers, the oranges. While it's got a dark background, her actual presence is kind of glowing. Beautiful painting, I love it. Captures a moment of life and vitality. You put that next to the lady with the pug down there, it's just another world altogether, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, so that's part two of our tour. We had the romantic landscapes, we had the Enlightenment versus the Romantics. Now we're going to move into the Victorian era. And this room, if you look down through there, to my eye it looks a bit like a Victorian drawing room. It's so cluttered. And I think the people who set that room up have done that deliberately, sort of like that's what a Victorian room would be like. In fact, that room was the first room in this gallery when this gallery started in the 1850s. And some of the paintings in there were some of the first paintings that this gallery purchased. Now, I'd like to say a few things about Victorian painting before we go in there to give you a sort of a clue as to what we're looking for. What you can see immediately in front of you on the left there is a group of paintings that were done by a school of artists called the Pre-Raphaelites. Pre-Raphaelites. They were young, they're about your age. They called themselves the Pre-Raphaelites because they wanted to do paintings that restored the age before Raphael. R-A-P-H-A-E-L. And who was Raphael? Do you know who Raphael was?
Sculptor, isn't
it? He was an artist. He might have sculpted. I thought he was more of a painter. But he was an artist and might have been a sculptor as well as a painter. But I can't remember his exact dates, but they were early Renaissance. And these artists wanted to go before Raphael, pre-Raphael, back to the time of the medieval period even. Why did they want to do this? Why do you think artists would want to do that in the middle of Industrial Revolution? What was driving artists to want their art to be pre-Raphaelite? What idiotic ideas were in their heads that they wanted to be pre-Raphaelite in the beginnings of modernism and industrialization? What would have triggered that need for them?
Queen Victoria was quite conservative.
She was what?
Very conservative.
She was very conservative, yeah. So how does that connect to what we're talking about?
She was in power.
She was in power, yeah, but I'm not seeing your connection in your mind between that and the pre-Raphaelite impulse. What's triggered that connection for you? Why did you say that?
Because I feel like that was more of a connection to God and
does that connect? How does that connect to Queen Victoria? You think they were sucking up to Queen Victoria? Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah.
Maybe.
No.
I don't know. I don't know whether Queen Victoria. I think Queen Victoria probably did like some of the Pre-Raphaelite paintings because some of them are very, very beautiful. What I'm trying to get at is why would artists in that kind of period of history want to take their imaginations back to the time before Raphael? Why would they? Abdul?
Not sure at all.
Not sure at all. Okay, let me try and think of a modern example. You know, you've seen the film The Hobbit. You've seen it. You have. What other big blockbuster films are there that attract audiences nowadays? Well, there's the series of big fat novels that were turned into films. I'm sure you've all read. I haven't read. God, what is it? Sorry? No, I'm thinking more of, they turned them all into films.
What was it about?
English schoolboys and magic and witches and
Harry Potter.
You've all seen Harry Potter. So, Harry Potter.
You haven't read Harry Potter.
Shh.
It's weird.
Getting to my kids. I hadn't had time to read it. Shh. Okay. So, Harry Potter. The Hobbit. What do those stories and films, how do they fit into the 20th century, the 21st century? What are people doing with stories like that? Exactly. Escaping, and of course the Industrial Revolution was also a time that was incredibly stressful and people were suffering. And these artists, Pre-Raphaelites, they wanted to connect with a time that was free of that stress. So that was the sort of impulse there in the Pre-Raphaelites. So when you go down there on the left, up until that huge painting in the middle, and have a good stop and look at that, look at the title of that, see what it says. See if you can tune into what the Pre-Raphaelites were trying to do. All right, once you get past that painting, on the left-hand side, there are a couple of really interesting ones there. There's one with red coats shooting. Check what the event is and what date it was painted. And then next to that, above that, see that rather dark painting? Well, there's a couple like that, but not many. That artist actually illustrated some of Charles Dickens' work. Now, what was Charles Dickens' relationship to the 19th century? You haven't read Hard Times yet, have you? You probably don't know anything about Dickens yet. No? Nothing. Nothing. Well, Charles Dickens was an author who didn't want to escape to the medieval time. He wanted to face the problems of the time and wanted to wake people up to the problems of the world. And that artist there was an illustrator for Dickens, and see that he's on the same page as Dickens, wanting to point out the problems of what was happening in Victorian England.
Those paintings, I don't doubt it, they were quite stressful for me.
Okay,
you
go and have a closer look. On the right hand side, which you can't see, on this wall here, there are about 10 paintings that represent Victorian women. Now, women in Victorian times is a huge subject in itself. How were women represented? It was a time, of course, when women had no freedom, but when women were waking up to the need for freedom. I don't know if you remember me referring to Mary Wollstonecraft in the first week. She was at the time of William Blake, 1780. She was telling women they had to get an education, they had to wake up to themselves, they needed to break out of the stereotypes. But Victorian times were full of stereotypes. So I'm wanting to see whether you can see the stereotypical representations of women down this right-hand wall. Because you're going to see women in all the novels we look at, the poetry we look at, and so on. So go together and walk right round this wall, and then we'll have to talk about some of them. don't walk past this one. And that's the description. Don't miss it. You've got to walk back a bit to get see it properly. Walk the side so you can get the glare off it. So I want you to go down that wall now, and there down there, and I want you to think about women, how they're represented. And I also want you to think about Hollywood. You know, at the time this gallery was open, there was no cinema, no television, no iPads, no phones. People used to come in here with their picnic baskets, sit down in front of these paintings and try and work out what was the story. There's this great interest in story in Victorian times. Every painting was telling a story of some sort. But it was also representing women in various guises. You've got Cleopatra up there, you've got Queen of Sheba up there. So go down and see if you can come to some sort of sense of what the diversity of representations of women were. okay, so what sort of impressions have you got? Let's go backwards from what you looked at. What sort of impressions have you got of the way that women are represented in Victorian times?
I saw a couple of stereotypes.
Yep.
So the kind of women that are the helpful women.
Yep,
the
like
good
here.
Helpful women,
yep.
And the rolling wool, the helping the men,
yep.
And
yep.
Helping the poor. And Cleopatra was kind of like a sexy femme fatale.
Yep, yep, good. Excellent, so you got that.
And then the white, there's a lot of whites, so like kind of like a pure Virgin Mary.
Yeah. So when you come to this one here, the larger version of this one down here.
Yeah.
It's the same artist. That's a sort of a small preparatory work we did before this one. This one here, well, what do you make of this?
She's sleeping, so she's fragile. She's wearing white, so she's pure.
And what impact is she having on this man? Well, look, that's interesting. The actual description of the painting, it seems to suggest that this is sort of a typical Victorian story where he was a bad man, a bad young man, and he comes to see this woman dressed in these white veils, and he reforms his character. He's decided to become a good man, and the sun's coming up over the horizon. So that's on one level. But on another level, as Abdul suggested, I mean, this woman, she might be in white, but she looks pretty sexy to me. She's sort of like, you know, she's there in the middle of the woods. Yeah, it's sort of like the Victorians had this kind of interesting morality. It was always sort of a bit twisted, a bit perverse, their morality was. So this painting is a very Victorian painting. It's like a Hollywood thing. The Victorians would have loved it because of all those conflicting kind of emotions in it. On the one hand, the moral of the young man being improved by a woman of virtue, lying there pure, etc. I don't know whether you agree with me. I mean, I could be mending a lot of this stuff. But to me, it seems that in her diaphanous gowns there, she's sort of very sensual. And, I don't know what these other figures are doing down here.
But it's not sensual in the same way that Cleopatra.
No,
it's like
not
it's
the same.
Innocent.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe unintentional.
That's true. Yeah. Okay. Let's turn around here. So you had a good look at that widower. The widower, his wife has died. His youngest daughter looks like she's got the same disease that the mother had. They're really struggling. The young kids are not too bothered. They don't understand the implications. But the teenage daughter at the back, she's well aware of what's going on. And Luke Fildes, I don't know if it mentions on there, he was an illustrator for Dickens. You saw that?
Yes.
That's right. Now this painting in the middle with the red coats, do you remember the opening scenes of Pandemonium, the film I showed you? You know, the redcoats came down and they were shooting into the crowd who were rebelling against authority. The painting is about the Gordon Riots, which occurred in 1780, which is throughout the beginning of the Romantic period. And the Gordon Riots, I can't remember exactly the context, but there were a crowd of people there who were rebelling against some taxation injustice, and they burnt one of the houses in the middle of London now, and the redcoats were sent in to shoot them.
This painting was celebrating.
It doesn't look like it's celebrating the protesters, not at all. It's affirming the power of the redcoats. Yeah. And it's painted in 1897, so it's painted 100 years after the event, the height of Victorian era. And as you said, I think one of you said that Queen Victoria was very stern and moralistic and wanted to hold society in order, so this painting confirms that. Okay, this big painting here, which is the last of a series of pre-Raphaelite, Ford Madox Brown, his name is on the plinth at the bottom. It's a painting done of the medieval period, and it's actually got a number of different levels to it. frames like a church window looking out onto a landscape. And it's looking 500 years earlier, to about the 1300s, when the father of English poetry, Geoffrey Chaucer, that's him, Geoffrey Chaucer, who wrote the Canterbury Tales. Have you read any of the Canterbury Tales ever? Worth reading, they're fantastic. The Canterbury Tales are about all. Partner, the nun, the miller.
The miller.
The miller's tale.
Kind of silly.
Right? Yeah, silly. Yeah. Well, one day you should read the Canterbury Tales because it's just wonderful, and captures all the different varieties of people in medieval England. And I think this painting is actually depicting some of the varieties of the people that were in Chaucer's poems as well. But he's reading the poems to Edward III. He's standing up there reading, and unfortunately for him, I feel very much for him, because a lot of these people around here are playing with their mobile phones or looking at their iPads or not listening to what he's saying. And he doesn't have the strength or the power to tell them to turn the bloody iPhones off. Yeah. Okay, well, you don't.
It doesn't look very happy or something that I don't want to escape to.
Okay, well, it's fair enough. You wouldn't want to escape to that. Well, it's very different to that, isn't it? It's evoking a world of relative simplicity, relative harmony, compared to the problems of the Industrial Revolution. And if you look at the Pre-Raphaelite paintings as a whole group, if you leaf through, if you go onto Google and look up Pre-Raphaelite paintings, you see painting after painting that's evoking different worlds, medieval worlds, worlds full of imagination, fantasy, worlds of great colour, energy, and all that kind of thing. Where's death and sadness in there? Not that one.
Well, not that I'm very happy.
Yep.
I'm not
particularly happy for that guy in the armour.
The guy in the armour,
yeah.
And the Fritters of the Wyatt, the dwarves look like goblins.
Yep,
like
yep,
goblins.
Yep.
True. And those paintings of the star.
Yep. Well, that's interesting what you're saying, is that despite the fact that the Pre-Raphaelites were sort of trying to escape from the circumstances, they couldn't really hide their sadnesses as well.
So you think? Okay.
Yeah, I think there's nothing wrong with that interpretation, yeah. So here you get a taste of Victorian England and all the diversity of things they were yearning for, things they were feeling about, ideals that they had. You're going to see a lot of this coming up in the literature that we're going to read. So, you know, why I bring you here, why I like bringing you here, is because you read the literature, but you don't have a kind of a full context of the culture of the time. And here you've got paintings that were produced when that literature was produced, with all the interests and the concerns of the time. And I didn't mention it, I should have mentioned it, that, you know, Sydney is filled with icons of the Victorian era. We've got the Victoria Building, Queen Victoria Building. We've got the Queen Victoria statue just outside it. The street that our university's on is Albert Road, and that was Queen Victoria's consort, Prince Albert. I will point out in a couple of weeks' time that the Botanic Gardens, they have a huge glass palace in there in 1870, and it burnt down about 3 years after it was built. It was a big kind of international business fair. It was called the Crystal Palace. It mirrored one they had in London. I'll be talking more about that when we come to Victorianism. Okay, there's one last thing I want to show you. Come this way. Okay. 19th century ends here, the 20th century starts here. This is the gate between them. This is done in 1895 by the French sculptor Auguste Rodin. And this is a miniature version of the actual one. Well, he built this as well, but it's a miniature version of the one that he built for London. It stands on the banks of the Thames, and the people, the figures are much larger than life. And if you go to the art gallery in Canberra, they've got a sculpture garden outside there. They've got a couple of these figures there in real life. Rodin, R-O-D-I-N. And this was done in 1895. Now, for me, what really separates the 19th century and the 20th century, and we're going to come into this in more detail next semester, the big difference is that the Victorian age, they represented life. It didn't have the emotional intensity of what happened in the 20th century. There was a lot of tragedy coming up in the 20th century, and the emotional intensity of these figures. If you look down there, for example, if you look at that figure of the man holding the snake. Okay, there's a lot of movement in his body, but there's something very posy about the Victorian world. Posy. Whereas this here, there's a great deal of suffering in each of these characters. Now, I'm going to tell you about the story about this. The first thing I'm going to say is that these six people have been depicted by Rodin because they all are about 3 minutes away of being executed. That's number one. I take that on board. I go around and have a look on their faces. Rodin wanted to kind of enter into the state of mind, the state of fear of what it was like to confront execution. There's been a lot of talk about execution in our news lately. What was the event that struck Rodin's imagination? Well, it's a historical story. It's a real story. It's called The Burghers of Calais. And Calais is a city in France, Belgium, that in the Renaissance was surrounded by armies and was being starved to death. It was being besieged. And finally, just before the town, nearly everybody in the town had died, there was still the town was still had some life in it. They were given an ultimatum. The ultimatum was send the six top burghers of your town out through the gate. When they come out of the gate, we're going to execute them, and then the town will be freed. That's the price you have to pay. There's a famous story. You can look it up on Wikipedia, the Burghers of Calais. It's a long story. And this touched Rodin so much as an artist. He wanted to just capture this suffering and struggle and despair that these men had to face in their willing going to their own death to free the town. That was what it was. So, you know, if you compare this to any sculpture in the 19th century, it's very different. As are the paintings when you go into there. You're not allowed to look there. That's the 20th century. That's for next semester. You're not allowed to go in there. Forbidden. So now that's the end of your tour. Now if you go back through that room, through the next room, and go back and have another look at romantic landscapes, just try and reconnect with that, get in your mind how you might use that for your essay this week. Have a talk together about some ideas you might share. All right?
Thanks.
Thank you. See ya.